Now, TalkZone presents Money at Work, the weekly show that addresses the issues of the day from a financial perspective. Now, here are your hosts, Brian Bourdon and Steve Memory.
Thank you. Welcome to this edition of Money at Work with OB Capital Management. It's June 12, 2014. As the man said, I'm Brian Bourdon. I'm joined by Steve Memory, also going to be joined by Lily Poy. It's our intention to have Lily talk to us a little bit about Social Security and put the wraps on the ETF cash flow. But the way things have been happening this week, Steve, we may have to weigh in on some other things. I don't know if we're going to get to everything because lots of noise is being made overseas, and it's not just the Ukraine this time. Under the category of uncertainty, when this is going to sound like a dumb question, but with what can we expect from uncertainty?
Well, it's the only thing you can expect from uncertainty is that we won't know.
What is the only thing we have to fear?
Exactly, fear itself. Apparently, if you have the ability to make a really bad pun about a place, it's open for disruption and fervor, I guess, because we had the Crimea River earlier this year. Now we're back to Iraq in a hard place. You know, we got, I guess, to Crete now. Is 75% back in the hands of someone other than ISIS, from what I see on today's news. But that would be because of the help of Iran. Now, if this just hasn't gotten completely weirded out, you know, I don't know. On the one hand, on the one side of the globe, you've got Syria, where your choice is to go ahead and fund the Al-Qaeda-led insurgents against a brutal, mass-murdering dictator. I mean, which choice do you have, right? Mass murderer or mass murderer? And then on the other hand, in Iraq now, we go ahead and we have the same insurgent militia of Iraq, of Al-Qaedaites going ahead and plotting the demise of various Sunni groups around, and are headed, I guess they're going to cut the faces off of everybody at the sacred sites of the Shiites, blowing up the Buddhist statues that had survived for millions of years as part of the Taliban didn't help things. So we got to go ahead and crush some other sacred sites.
We can
fight those people with nuclear weapons and the mass murdering type of people in Iran, those Shiites.
But this could be for something new, because there was a spokesman from Iran who said that the reason they're doing this is they have old scores to settle.
Exactly. Yeah, it's only 1300 or 1400 years old. Okay. But, you know, hey, look, from Gulf War II, we've long learned to discount spokesmen. Okay. You know, when the last official.
I still miss that guy from the old airport.
I know. As he's trying to get on his plane to escape the country.
Kevin,
the war is not over. We are not losing the battle. We are winning on all fronts. We are, matter of fact, we just bombed New York.
As he drops through the scaffold.
It just went ahead and made it. He was hilarious, though. You had to love him. Anyway, I don't know. You know, when we started the year off, we're looking at a couple of things that would go ahead and give us reasons to pause from a growing or some decent returns in the marketplace. Those three areas we were looking at were, you know, as we said, there was no real shoe out there to drop. So, and that's the kind of time you get nervous, because you don't know what to look for. We had emerging markets, which were a potential powder keg. How were they going to react? Were they going to go ahead and have a problem? Turns out they did. They dropped off 9% before turning around and now rallying up about 14% from that low point in February, and now they're doing pretty well. Even China is not feeling so much pressure to go ahead and add things to its economy. It's going ahead and loosening its bank reserve requirements, but only in rural areas or for small businesses. So it feels like it doesn't have to go ahead and open the floodgates of cash and create a real big inflationary environment. You know, so they're at 7.4% year-over-year earnings in their in But still, I mean, fairly decent. So if,
seven,
and they have
7.4 would be very attractive here in America.
Oh, sure. Well, if we had 7.4, we'd have booming inflation.
We'd have an expansion here, right?
Yeah. So that's you know, that's one thing. It would be nice to see that kind of a circumstance stabilize for us. One of the other areas we were looking at was the GDP growth. Now, the World Bank, as you may know, came out and cut their global growth forecast, looking for global growth around 2.8% this year. That's down from 3.2% in January. The U.S. forecast was 2.8. They cut that down to 2.1%. Largely, that's off of essentially we had first quarter contraction of 0.1%. So they basically took one quarter out of their estimate for the year and just removed that. And essentially, I guess the World Bank doesn't believe that, that we're going to go ahead and have that coiled spring effect. The Fed, on the other hand, still does, and they expect a, larger than expected, second, third, and fourth quarter to make up for that first quarter, that essentially that, that demand was still there, and we'll go ahead and we'll see it in some form or another. The weak link in the chain, according to the Fed, though, is the U.S. housing market. So we've seen some generally rosy circumstances. We haven't quite seen exactly what, you know, a real booming housing market here. The International Monetary Fund, the IMF, on the other hand, has come out and said pretty much we're looking at we're on the verge of a bubble, I guess, in global housing prices. I'm not sure exactly where or how. But the data that they've come out with and said many places are well above their historical averages, and that this is a cause for some concern.
Did they say where these places were?
No, apparently the waterfront property in the Crimea is really hot right now. That's where everything's going. And from what I hear, there are people just buying up swaths of property in the middle of Iraq. Other than that, I don't know. I mean,
this is real property value stuff, though, when they're yeah, talking about the housing market, because listen, interest rates are still favorable if you want to, you know, if you want to buy a house, if you want to buy a house over, you know, 360 months, you know, you can probably do so for 4.5, maybe even as low as 4.25. Mm-hmm. So that's not the issue. So it must be real property values. Just not, on the one hand, you know, housing's weak here, and then there's talking about a bubble.
Yeah, they're talking internationally. They're talking apparently that the prices for housing internationally is above historical levels. They're extrapolating that to essentially creating a housing bubble.
Well, you know, I actually did, you know, listen to some of those housing numbers. Mm-hmm. You know, in April, there was a 1.1 million unit housing start, but it was largely rental. And
is that domestic or is that international?
Domestic. No, this is in the U.S. And yeah, I think historically,
we were looking at home sales of in April of about 433,000.
Right. But I guess if you look close at the numbers, you know, like you if you really want GDP growth, I think you really need new construction. Don't you think? I mean,
sure,
the regular resale, they don't really add a lot, you know, to GDP growth, you know, like the used homes.
And housing is, I mean, a fairly small part, but an important part of overall GDP growth. You know, a lot of things come from housing. So if you have a decent housing growth, then what you're going to see is also consumer purchases, you know, consumer durable products, appliances, that sort of thing, home improvement. Mm-hmm. And everything that comes along from there, you know, so that a solid foundation in home buying is, you know, is not necessarily a requirement, but indicative at least of a burgeoning, healthy growing economy. So we've seen 433,000, homes sell in, April. That was the annual rate. The housing starts in April came out much larger or much better than were expected, but still we're at the historical lows. When we take a look at the indicators, we're pretty much at and are, at least domestically, our historic lows for both sales and construction activity. The next few months we see here, you know, coming through the summer, June, July, August, tend to be peak months. Kids are out of school. It's before school starts up again, and that's when most people with of family age, let's say, go ahead and tend to make their moves. And so the great bulk of people who are relocating tend to go ahead and move during these summer months. That's when a lot of this really kind of takes hold. So we're going to have to be paying attention pretty closely over the next few months to those housing numbers to get a decent idea as to whether or not that can provide that foundation for GDP growth that we're looking for.
Yeah, yeah. And I think job growth, too, that's also an important element when it comes to housing. And I think Midwest, right, that's where the job growth is because of the manufacturing and fracking.
Well, Midwest and Southwest, I mean, Texas is taking quite a few jobs at this point. There's a lot of even international companies going ahead and headquartering there for a couple of reasons. One, it's low interest rates and low tax rates for both corporations and individuals. And also, too, they're a right-to-work state. And as we've seen for some time now, right-to-work states have been pulling jobs from union states in fairly dramatic fashion. So, I mean, you know, it's if you had to go ahead and guess where are, you know, businesses moving to, you'd probably say, well, Texas, right? You'd be right. Mm-hmm. Where are they coming from? Well, pick a state. You know, New York, yes, absolutely. Texas, yes, again, absolutely. So California is, you know, has a lot of small counties that are desperate to go ahead and hang on to their businesses, and they're moving. Toyota recently moved its headquarters out of California, and they're moving to Texas. Mm-hmm. You know, I forget. Anyway, there's a number of places that I've seen recently that are going ahead and relocating to Texas. Texas is a big place. They're gaining a lot of jobs.
Right. Yeah. And I think Denver is the only state that the prices of house has passed the previous housing boom.
The city of Denver or the state of Colorado?
State of Colorado.
I wonder if the new moratorium on marijuana has anything to do with that.
Maybe we should all go to have pot belly.
Anyway.
No, I'm just kidding.
I don't know. Anyway, the third leg of the stool here was market uncertainty, and we're seeing this now. Our big concern, of course, beforehand had been Ukraine, and we kind of felt that, okay, nothing was going to happen. The United States was not going to do anything in Ukraine, and it's kind of resolved itself. They're down now to the point in time where they're actually negotiating. So the negotiations occur back and forth between the Ukraine. They're talking to each other and they're fine. Putin and Obama can't talk to each other. They're like, you know, a couple of junior high school kids who, you know, were going together previously. And then all of a sudden they, you know, somebody kissed somebody else and now they can't even look at each other or touch each other.
Or they're both interested in the same girl.
Yeah, something like that. I don't know. But anyway, so the idea is that some of it's stabilizing, but now we've got all this Iraq stuff on the horizon, and it's not even just Iraq; it's sectarian. Mm-hmm. So the Kurds have gone ahead and moved down into the oil rich areas, and they're taking over some of some territory as well. So everybody's getting kind of opportunistic on that.
Well, we're going to put a cap on this when we come back at the end of the first break, because I want to make sure that we kind of make our points here before we kind of move on to the next leg of the stool there. You're listening to Money at Work with OV Capital Management with Brian Bourdon, Steve Memory, and Lily Poy. You can get a message to us by calling us at 855-691-8800. That's toll free. Or sending us a message to answers@moneyatworkradio.com. We'll be back right after these messages.
Welcome back to Money at Work on Talk Zone. Here's Brian Bourdon and Steve Memory.
All right, welcome back to the second segment of our program for this afternoon. Just wanted to let you know that if you're going to be in the area on Saturday morning, and I mean Old Town Alexandria, 109 South Fairfax to be specific, from 10 till noon, Steve will be here, I'll be here, Lily will be here, and we'll be entertaining folks, having some coffee, bagels. I think last week we even had some donuts that seemed to be a big hit. Farmers markets going on as well. So come on in and see us, and we'll talk about anything that's on your mind. We were talking about uncertainty before the break, and Lily, you had a good question for Steve off the air, as you usually do, you ask all your best questions off the air. So I'm going to ask you to ask that question again and just see if we can get Steve on a nice little rant here.
Okay, so which one did you want me to ask?
The one where you were asking about the trouble over in the Middle East, the oil dependency.
Right, okay, all right. Well, you know, that area actually has always been unfriendly, right? I mean, the only thing that they do is to cause trouble.
Yes, right. They don't get along well.
Right, and it seems like the only thing that they're good at doing is just cause a lot of instability, you know, in the world. I don't know if it's fanatic religious purpose or hatred, you know, toward the West, or they just have that problem, you know, for, what, centuries ago? But anyway, so I was just saying, do we really need to spend as much energy toward these unfriendly nations as we did before, you know, since we're talking about, you know, energy independence and natural gas and all that in the U.S.?
Well, as I mentioned at the break, yes, for a myriad of reasons, not the least of which is the fact the United States is not energy independent at this point in time. You know, we have a lot of things that are out there, but, you know, fracking has its detractors. And because of that, there was a very large pool of oil resources that was reduced, its capacity estimation was reduced by about 90% because of some of the difficulties we have in going ahead and from a PR perspective, I guess I'd say, getting a lot of this shale oil out. So, you know, we're not, while it's there, if we had the political and popular will to go ahead and remove it, it's not the kind of thing that is really the savior of the global or the U.S. economy, you know, at this point in time. There's a number of reasons, and we can get into them from either there are political reasons not to go ahead and have that because there are people who are tied to green energy, and that's what they want. They want to go ahead and have renewable resources. And the only way for renewable resources to go ahead and come to the fore is essentially to make them cheap by comparison. Well, you can't really make them cheaper, so what do you have to do? You have to make everything else more expensive. Making oil more expensive doesn't happen when you can go ahead and pull a bunch of it out of the U.S. Simply by, you know, putting some fracking water in there and extracting it at a reasonable price. So there are interests at bay, if you will, that are designed to go ahead and keep that from necessarily coming forward. If you take a look at the net energy imports since 85, okay, we were somewhere around the 7%, 7 quadrillion BTUs of net energy being imported. We had a peak in 2006 of about 30 quadrillion BTUs. We're down from that point right now. We're closer to the 12 quadrillion BTU net import. But hey, look, that's still a net import. We're far from going ahead and being energy independent. The chart looks pretty dramatic in that we've turned the leg on things. But we're still going ahead and we're still bringing oil in here. And anything that goes ahead and disrupts oil coming from, well, gee, where are the other two places that people get oil? One is Siberia. The other is the Middle East. That's going to have an impact long term on the cost of oil and the cost of energy. And energy is what drives the global economy. Okay. Don't kid yourself. Without oil, without the energy to do anything, we're not going to be able to go ahead and be competitive. We're not going to drive prices. So, yes, the fact is that we're going to have to go ahead and pay close attention to this.
Well, nobody's going to go to war to take your windmill away from you either.
Well,
Don Quixote, maybe, but that's about it. Solar power and wind power and all these other things are nice. They're nice ideas, but the bottom line is the world runs on oil, and it will for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and those alternative resources have not been proven at this point in time to be sufficient to take over the job.
Okay? All they are, and that's all just they're one designed side. To do is be sufficient to prevent the U.S. from accessing its own oil reserves. That seems to be their primary function.
There are some things out there, you know, that are okay as far as being able to produce energy. But, you know, in order to go ahead and take over from oil, you'd need to cover the world in solar collecting windmills, you know, and that's just where the technology stands right now. It's not as efficient as we'd like to go ahead and see it. The other side, of course, is
one great big one.
Yeah, like I told Brian,
it's like solar wind, right?
Yeah. The wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always come out, right?
Right. Yeah, but hey, if you use solar wind,
oil is forever, baby.
Anyway, look, the point is that there's a significant economic situation. The second thing, of course, is, as you mentioned, there are certain geopolitical and religious overtones. Okay, Al-Qaeda is a religious organization, if an extreme one. It is at least a religious one. It has its roots in the Islamic faith. And those conflicts, for us, seem relatively new, but it's a conflict that has gone on for millennia, okay, since the time of the Crusades. Let's not forget that, it was in Sarajevo, World War I was started by, Franz Ferdinand being shot, but he was shot by, essentially what we would call now a Muslim extremist. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that started that was the minor little thing that kicked off two world wars, really. Then, of course, you know, there was you can go through the myriad things that were out there, like from the attempted assassination of the Pope to the first attempt at there's the coal, there's the first attempt at the World Trade Center, of course, the planes that flew into the World Trade Center and that sort of thing. All of these things are terrorist versions of a battle that is being brought to our doorsteps by a militant faction of a particular religion. And they see that they, as it was explained to me and I don't want to go ahead and I guess pass on too much information or take someone's story, but there was a gentleman I know who was affiliated with one of the agencies that are out there, and he met in a particular time clandestinely with one of the leaders of an Al-Qaeda offshoot in the attempt to see if there was the possibility for a common ground area. His question was, what are you looking for? You know, what is it that you want from us that we can give you? And the guy laughed at him and said, we don't want anything from you. We want you to cease to exist as a particular country. The very premise of a democratic country is counter to their view of Islam. Okay? Islam is submission to Allah, putting men in charge of their own destiny is a subversion of that religion in its base form. So that's why we have a fundamental at odds issue with Al-Qaeda. Okay, going in away from all the other stuff. If you want to boil it down very simply, it is a very different worldview from two very different ideologies. Al-Qaeda now has the possibility of creating another stronghold in here. We will be forced to deal with them. They will make sure of it. So the idea that we can go ahead and pull out all our troops and leave the whole country to whoever wants to run it over is a fallacy. Okay, we will be back there. We will have to be back there. You can't go ahead and win a war from the air. It doesn't work. It goes against every known military construct that you can bomb somebody into submission. Case in point, World War II, Germany felt in the Blitz that you could go ahead and just bomb England into submission, that's all they had to do. It was known as the Battle of Britain, and it didn't work out real well for the Germans because air power is not the same as people on the ground. You have to have boots. Everything, as my my grandfather told me, everything supports the infantry. Okay? Don't make any mistake about it.
You got to occupy the ground. It's what the game Monopoly is based on.
Exactly. You have to occupy space. You have to occupy territory. You can either do that from a chess strategy or from a go strategy. Either one will work, but you still have to be able to go ahead and project influence on the ground. And we've removed all of our troops from Iraq, and that just left that power vacuum there. Mm-hmm. So from a secondary standpoint, we will have to go ahead and at some point in time find ourselves in the circumstance where we are, whether it's through Kennedy-style advisors, or whether it's with actual boots of U.S. soldiers on the ground, we will have to go ahead and take some possession in Iraq of what's going on there. And that will cost money, and that will be counterproductive to our GDP growth. But it's unfortunate. It's much easier to go ahead and stay fit than it is to have to go ahead and lose weight and on a diet. But we're facing now a situation where we had the diet, we lost the weight, and we went back to sitting on the couch and eating bonbons. So, it's unfortunate, and it's a difficult, but it's a mistake, and it was made by this administration. And I'm not going to be the last person to say it. I'm certainly not the first person to say it. Mm-hmm. And it's going to cost us money, and it's going to cost us GDP. But that's long term. A lot needs to happen between now and then. So.
Well, there's 2 years to go, and I think that people recognize that this is where their opportunity lies. Certainly, Putin's doing what he's doing, figuring he's got 2 years to get this done before he has someone else to treat with. And as religious as some of these offshoots are in the Middle East, they're also politically savvy enough to know what's going on and that they have a finite time before they get another possibly another Bush in the White House that they have to deal with.
Sure. So the idea would be to consolidate gains and create a caliphate. If that happens, that's what we may be dealing with when we be left out in the cold.
Well, we're going to get on with the rest of our lives when we come back from the break. There are other things
going on.
Yes,
we're
thank
bring
God
you back.
We can talk we're about
bring
other
you,
things.
We're going to bring you back to this side of the water. We're going to talk about some of the ways that we look at companies here and how we evaluate them. And I think you're going to find that interesting. So stay where you are. We'll be back in about 90 seconds. You're listening to Money at Work with OB Capital Management.
And now more of Money at Work on TalkZone.com. Here's Brian Bourdon and Steve Memory.
Thank you. Welcome back to the second half hour of Money at Work here with OV Capital Management on TalkZone.com, coming to you from beautiful downtown Old Town Alexandria, where we will be from 10 a.m. till noon this coming Saturday. So stop by and see us. We'll give you a cup of coffee, a donut, and talk a little bit. Lily will be here as well as Steve and me. And if you want to call us, you can do so at 855. This is toll free, 855-691-8800. You can email us. Answers at moneyatworkradio.com, or you can look us up on the interweb at www.ovcapital.net. Those are three very convenient ways to get a hold of us, see what's on our mind, and also tell us what's on your mind. I mean, we were talking earlier today, Steve, about the VIX, which is the volatility index, or the fear index, as some people like to call it, and it's checking in at 11. It goes to 100. So you see 11 is very low, and either there's complacency, or maybe I think there's just basically boredom. Like you said, there just isn't that, we haven't seen that big shoe out there to drop as we keep talking about. And I likened it earlier to, with these things that kind of pop up, all of a sudden GDP is not what it should be. And, housing is mired down, and we're like the proverbial frog sitting in the cool water and having the heat turned up on us. And before we know it, we're going to be looking around for a shoe, and then the lights go out because we just boiled to death.
Yeah. I mean, you think about the expansion or the recovery is approaching its sixth year. So, let's do a market recap. Year to date, you look at the S&P, as at the end of last week, because this week is not over yet. Year to date, the S&P is up 6.44%. The Dow, you know, is a little bit under, you know, 3.14%. Russell, which is a small cap, has the lowest growth. It's not even 1%. But amazingly, emerging market has done pretty decently, don't you think, Steve? Emerging market?
It was the leading sector, actually, yeah.
Is it the leading sector?
Yeah.
And it was
yeah.
the biggest disappointment early in the year.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, it has the most volatility, and it's one of the more, from a risk standpoint, it's one of the riskier sectors. And so it goes to figure that it would be one of the, and you know, emerging markets being a higher risk, you tend to get compensated for taking risk. And so it gives you the better returns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to talk about some of the investments that we're interested here at OV Capital. And typically what happens is we start talking, we get a little bit far afield, and then I don't give you enough time, Steve, to talk about exactly all the hit the high points that you want to. And I'm leading in early because one of the things that I want you to look at and kind of, you know, give a little bit of an oration on for us is the quick ratio, because I know that's something that it's one of the tools in your toolbox that you use when you're evaluating companies. It's, you know, like we say, there isn't only one, but this is one that kind of gives you an idea of how much further into this company do you want to go, because it kind of tells you how they're running their day-to-day business, doesn't it?
It does. Quick ratio, by its name, almost you can kind of tell that what we're looking at is short-term liquidity. Okay, so it is the quick money. It's okay. A bill comes, you need to go ahead and stick your hand in a pile of cash. Where does that pile of cash come from? For individuals, it's what's in your savings account or what's in your brokerage account. You're not likely to be able to go ahead and sell your house in a short enough time to pay off a debt. So you wouldn't consider, you know, that sort of thing as quick money. Corporations, it's kind of similar. Okay. So your, cash and your cash equivalents, your marketable securities, those are, either, bonds that you owned or stocks that you own as a corporation. And also your accounts receivable. Most accounts receivable tends to be around 30 days. In some cases, they're 60 or 90 days, and usually there's an incentive in account receivable to pay it early. But those monies, account receivables, tend to be quick assets because they're coming in. It's not like, well, you've got to wait a year for them. On the other hand, inventories, you don't know when an inventory is going to be sold. You know, it may sell tomorrow. It may sell in 180 days. It may sell in a couple of years. So inventory tends to be the area that's considered, okay, we're going to discount that. And the definite and the difference between the quick ratio and the current ratio is that the current ratio includes inventories. A quick ratio excludes inventories.
And that's important because, you know, quick and current, we're talking about current assets. So don't get current assets confused with the current ratio. And that's what you want to look at. Just remember that quick means the absence of the inventory. So when you're doing a quick ratio, that's what you want to be thinking of. And that, because it's immediate, I guess immediate more than current.
Right.
And those two terms actually pretty critical, you know, because I did study accounting. So quick ratio and, you know, people do need to look at it. You know, quick ratio is
quick ratio. Once
how
we
fast
take
you can
all
pay
those,
your bills,
right? Once we take all that, once we take all those numbers, all your current assets, your cash and equivalents, your securities, marketable securities, and your accounts receivable, we add those all up. We divide them by your current liabilities. And that is the quick ratio. So anything over one is going to be a decent number, okay? Put it this way. For example, if your current cash and equivalents total $5 million and your marketable securities also are $5 million and your account receivable are $10 million, the total of that would be $20 million. If your total liabilities were totaled $20 million, that would give you a quick ratio of one.
So one means that you can cover the bases, but just cover the bases. You can cover your expenses, but that's it. You don't have an extra dime.
Right. You have enough, you're sufficient to cover your current liabilities. If, however, your accounts receivable total, let's say, $5 million, okay, and your cash and cash equivalents are 2.5, and your marketable securities are 2.5, all of that added together now comes to $10 million. $10 million divided by your total liabilities of 20 would give you a quick ratio of 0.5. So you can see anything under 1 means that you don't have sufficient cash reserves to cover all
so
of your immediate debts.
At 0.5 rather, you have right. half of what you need to pay off your short-term liabilities.
That's right. That's exactly right. And we focus on this oftentimes, particularly with regard to dividend-paying companies, okay? Something that has a substantial dividend that we're going to look at for an income stream. We like to know that they have sufficient cash reserves in from their quick ratio to be able to go ahead and continue paying that dividend without having to cut it or suspend it. Okay, if the quick ratio on a dividend payer is down to a 0.5, that dividend is probably in danger. They're likely to go ahead and need to boost cash reserves. And to do so, one of the first places they're going to look at is the dividend. Conversely, if a company has a quick ratio of closer to 3, there may be the possibility that they're going to increase that dividend because they have excess cash. So this is one of the reasons we go ahead. We evaluate the quick ratio. We want to see how they're doing, as far as a going concern. How liquid are you? How likely is it that you're going to be around in the next month or two or next year or so to be able to go ahead and pay those dividends?
And that's one of the things that goes into it. And that tells you kind of, do you want to go any further in?
Yeah, sure. Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Companies can be well run and they can have low debt to equity, or they can have high debt to equity. They can have low quick ratios. And part of that is going to be dependent upon what we're looking to invest in the particular company for.
Okay. Well, talk to me about Steel Dynamics. Talk to me about that company. And as you go through it,
sure.
let's let people know what the quick ratio is and, determine whether or not it's an advantageous one.
Okay. Let's see. Well, let me just say one thing in wrapping up what we were talking about beforehand. We threw out a lot of bad news that's out there, and there's a lot of concern and a lot of things that we really want to go ahead and stay on top of. But that doesn't mean that we are bearish according to the marketplace. Okay, that doesn't mean that we think the market is a bad place to put money at this point in time. On the contrary, we've seen a number of things out there that look pretty darn good. In particular, when we go ahead and we take a look at what the S&P Capital IQ consensus estimate for earnings per share is, we're looking at about an expectation for the next coming year of about 12.4% on an increase. And that's pretty darn good. We like to go ahead and be involved with that. So we still find that equities are the place to be when it comes to investing. Certainly when it comes to risk reward, it's a better circumstance than, say, fixed income or just cash, let's say, okay? In any case, let's take a look at Steel Dynamics. Steel Dynamics, the symbol on Steel Dynamics is STLD. They're currently trading at about 1724 right now, and we have a dividend of about 2.65% on this particular stock. This is a mid-cap value stock, which trades on the NASDAQ, and just to give you a little bit of a background, the company is a mini mill producer of steel products, flat road steel, structural steel, special bar quality steel. They produce joists, girders, decking for non-residential buildings, etc. They're one of the largest metal recyclers in the United States. Their steel shipments were 6.1 million tons in 2013. That was up from 5.8 million tons in 2012. Their average external sales price per ton was $793 per ton in 2013, down from $831 in 2012. So you can see they're paying less for their external steel. Their scrap cost was $353 a ton versus $378, so that price went down as well. When we're looking at a steel producer, the primary factor affecting steel products is economic growth. Okay, growth in demand for durable goods particularly. So what we're talking about in durable goods is autos, construction, appliances, containers, machinery, etc. Okay, so there's a lot of things that are very heavily tied to the essentially GDP and growth of the economy. So that's one of those things that we want to go ahead and be very aware of. Now, in this particular case with Steel Dynamics, there are a couple of flies in the ointment, and when we come back, I guess, we'll probably have to go ahead and pick those up.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I don't always leave you enough time, so I have to bring you over segment. It's like, remember the old 8-track tapes we used to listen to?
Exactly.
And the song would fade out that it'd pick up,
yeah,
on, the,
it'd pick up
on the next track. That's kind
one
of
one of the most annoying things in the world.
Oh, yeah. That's like, I hope you didn't put your money in 8-track tapes. this is our final break of the day. We're going to be back right after this. Steve's going to put a cap on STLD for us, and then we'll get on to our next one. So you're listening to Money at Work with OV Capital Management. We'll be back right after these messages.
You're listening to Money at Work on TalkZone.com. Back to Brian Bourdon and Steve Memory.
All right, welcome back. The last segment of Money at Work for June 12, 2014. I'm Brian Bourdon. I'm with Steve Memory and Lily Poy. One last time, invite you out here to 109 South Fairfax Street on Saturday from 10 to noon. Have some coffee and a bagel or a donut with us, and let's talk about economics and what's going on in the world. You'll meet all three of us there if you like. Steve, we were talking about STLD before we went to break.
Yep.
And I thought you could put the finishing touches on that and then maybe give us another one before it's time to go.
Yeah. Well, let's just say we have a little volatile earnings under STLD, Steel Dynamics. We were down about 19% on a quarter-over-quarter basis, but we feel that we're seeing the potential for EPS to see some significant growth in the coming year. By your request, we wanted to go ahead and take a look at that quick ratio. The quick ratio on Steel Dynamics is 1.3. So you can see that they do have the ability to go ahead and continue paying that dividend.
That's if you're keeping score at home. They've got about 30% more in current assets than they do in current liabilities.
Exactly. When we take a look at some of the other numbers, well, let me just get back to the earnings projections actually real quick here. We did 83 cents versus 73 cents in a year-over-year basis. We're looking for improvement on this year at $1.17 against 83 cents. So as you can see, the market expects some big things out of Steel Dynamics. But we take a look at the price to earnings, the PE ratio, and we're at a bit of a discount. We're sitting at 22.15, I guess. Peers are at 28.35. The price to projected earnings, PPE, is 10 for Steel Dynamics versus an 18.79. So you can see in these cases, we're looking at a pretty well discounted stock. The projected, the price to earnings growth, is 54 cents on Steel Dynamics versus 8.89 for peers. Price to book also at a discount, as well as we are on price to sales, and sales growth is substantially higher for Steel Dynamics than it is for its metals and mining peers. We're currently trading about 23% on the oversold side of the 10-week trading band. Middle of the trading band is at $18.09. Major support at $16.50, and the top of the trading range is at $20 a share, or excuse me, $20. We are buyers of STLD at this particular point in time. We think anything below the $17.50 price point is a good buy. It, based on the valuation and risk metrics in particular, we're looking at a substantial amount of upside for the amount of risk we take to the downside. We have a target of $21 a share. So OV Capital is buying STLD in select portfolios.
Okay, remember that this is what we're buying for ourselves and our clients, and you should consult with your own investment advisor before taking any actions on what you hear here. And also, Remember that OV Capital Management, we're a registered investment advisory. We're headquartered in the state of Virginia and subject to all the rules and regulations governing such entities in the great Commonwealth. So, Steve, move on. We've got another one we wanted to talk about here, one you've been looking at, and tell us about that one.
Sure. The other stock we were taking a look at is Danaher. I know we've talked about a number of mid-cap stocks as of late, so we wanted to go ahead and include some large cap in here as well. So Danaher, the symbol on Danaher, DHR. Danaher is currently trading the $80 range. See if we can go ahead and get a quick quote for you. $80.06 is what I have right now. That could be a little delayed. But Danaher is a large cap stock trading on the New York Stock Exchange. They are a diversified and leading maker of tools and process / environmental controls. Telecommunications equipment. They're an equipment manufacturer. They have a fairly diversified portfolio. Hand tools, process equipment, environmental equipment, etc. They have five reporting segments, the largest of which is life sciences and diagnostics. Essentially what they are, they're providing research and clinical tools for scientists to study cells and their components and various biological, complex biological sciencey stuff. Okay.
Sign me up.
Exactly. The company is a well-run company. They expand revenues through internal growth and the ability to go ahead and make sure internally that they are performing well, but also they do a lot of growth by acquisition. I've asked you this question earlier, and I could ask this of Lily. She's probably looking it up right now ahead of me. Lily, in 2013, can you guess how many companies DHR Danaher acquired?
I don't know that.
You don't. Take a guess.
20?
Okay, 20. Not quite 20. They did they did 13 businesses in 2013, the same number that it acquired in 2012. They acquired 14 businesses in 2011, 19 in 2010. Over the course of a five-year period, the company has spent $10 billion on acquisitions.
If this had been 2010, Lily, you'd have been right.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, actually, I'm a little bit familiar with the company. I think it's a real favorite with a lot of the investment club people.
Oh,
and they
sure.
Really,
yeah.
They do a lot of fundamental analysis, and they really love this company.
Well, there's a reason for it. It's actually been up about 31.5% over the past year. So it outpaced the market. It's done really well.
Well, Steve, you were talking about the companies they've acquired, and the companies they do acquire, they leave the management in place and let those companies run themselves, not pretty much taking them over and saying, okay, we know everything and we're going to do this our way, you know, and the Danaher way. And there's only one way, and that's the Danaher way. They really realize that if they're acquiring these companies, they're doing it for a reason, and they leave their strengths in place.
Mm-hmm. They are notorious for not overpaying for companies. They go ahead and they buy good, solid companies with good management, and they let them do their work. But they integrate the companies into the Danaher family. It's not like they just own a bunch of different companies that are out there. They actually go ahead and provide integration. There's some economies of scale that they take advantage of as a result. But they don't sit there and feel the need to go ahead and change the entire culture or go ahead and mess with what's going on. So this is your classic well-run company. They have a strong cash flow. Matter of fact, we go ahead and we take a look at the quick ratio on them. They have a quick ratio of 1.58. So you can see, they have a substantial quick ratio. They look real good from that position. They have a very low debt to equity ratio at 0.15. Some of the streamlining activities we don't expect to see really accrete to the bottom line until next year. And that's part of where we come into the little bit of difficulty with Danaher right now, okay? Because the price has jumped. It's 31.5%, 31.53 over the past year. It's kind of driven it up to a point where it's fairly expensive. Okay, this is a great company. We love this company, but the problem is it's not just company that we're out after. We're out for a company at a good price. Okay, the price to earnings ratio for Danaher sits at 21.9 versus its peers of 19.96. The historic 5-year history of the PE for Danaher tends to move between the 16.1 up to about 23.2. So you can see it's on the high end of its own 5-year PE average. The price to projected earnings is 19.11 versus 17.6 for the peers, so at a premium there. The earnings growth that we're looking at for Danaher is 4.31 versus 64.9. We discount that just a little bit. When we go ahead and we take a look at the price to sales, we're sitting at $2.88 versus peers of $2.23, and that's a bit of a premium. The five-year historic average of price to sales for Danaher is between a range of 1.53 and 2.98. So you can see, again, we are at that very high end on a five-year basis. Danaher's trading at 87% on the overbought side of its 10-week trading band. Middle of the trading band is at 75.29, minor support at 72. The bottom of the trading range is sitting at 69. Major support is at 65. So you can see there's a lot of things that are substantially lower than where the price is as far as risk-reward is concerned. Based upon that, based upon the fundamental valuation and our estimate of an $85 target price for Danaher, we have a hold on Danaher at this particular point in time. We'd like as an entry point for Danaher $70.50. If we can get it back at that particular point in time, then you're getting a good buy. So OB Capital does not currently own Danaher in portfolios. Danaher's symbol is DHR, large cap stock on the New York Stock Exchange.
All right, that's about all we have time for today. I'm just going to leave you with this thought. If you are a company out there and you have a 401k plan with a self-direction component to it, give us a call. Steve and I will be happy to come out and visit with you and let you know what we can do for you and for your employees. And, again, you can reach us at 855-691-8800. That's toll-free. Been a pleasure to be with you this afternoon. We'll look forward to seeing you next Thursday. For Steve Membry and Lily Poy, I'm Brian Bourdon. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to Money at Work.